My name is Penny Craswell, and I am a design writer, editor, and curator based in Sydney. For this issue of NGV magazine, I wrote about symbols and objects of death, remembrance, and mourning in design and making, looking closely at design works in the NGV collection, as well as common symbols in our lives. Designing the Unknown, Symbols and Objects of Death, Remembrance and Mourning in Design and Making. Death is not the opposite of life, but a part of it, Haruki Murakami. I was about 10 years old when I saw my first death mask. Ned Kelly's face seemed almost serene, eyes closed, head smooth, propped up in a glass display case at the old Melbourne jail. The memory of that moment has stayed with me all these years. Standing there, I had a powerful sense of fascination mixed with fear. This was not some horror movie or boogeyman. This was a real man, a real corpse. And his life was really taken here, at these gallows. Death has long held fascination for us. Our own deaths may present something to fear, something to ponder, something to prepare for. Other people's deaths also can be profoundly affecting. Mourning is a vital part of the human experience, and we memorialise loved ones in various ways. Death masks are interesting because they make something ephemeral, a living face, concrete and eternal, relatively speaking. Dating back to ancient Egypt, the death mask has been used to record the faces of rulers and famous figures in history. From Tutankhamun to Dante, Beethoven to Napoleon, they are not made for just anybody. Someone has to be famous, or infamous, to have a death mask. Death masks are one of a number of different artifacts and objects that are associated with mortality. The skull is another common symbol. Plenty of other objects are also traditionally associated with death, including coffins, shrouds, gravestones and plaques, urns, mourning jewellery and clothes. In recent decades, many of these objects have been reworked by contemporary designers, while other designers confront the subject through works that express grief or symbolise remembrance. One of the most interesting contemporary design explorations is Vespers 2016, a series of death masks designed and created by Israeli-American designer Neri Oxman and her team, the Mediated Matter Group at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. The masks, which were displayed in the inaugural NGV Triennial Exhibition of Contemporary Art and Design in 2017-18, are a contemporary reinterpretation of the ancient death mask, made by 3D printing using spatial mapping algorithms. There are three series, Vespers 1, 2 and 3, 2006, each with five masks. The first series, Vespers 1, is inspired by ancient death masks that were often made with precious stones and minerals. Five colours were selected, each corresponding to a colour found in an ancient death mask. Then an algorithm was used to select colours and shapes to additively build the masks. Vespers 2 is a development of the first series, a stepping stone from the ancient past to the future of technology. Vespers 3 takes the idea of the death mask one step further. These have been brought to life through the addition of living microorganisms which can be seen coursing through the nearly colourless shell. Oxman and her team synthetically engineered a variety of different microorganisms, which were placed inside the mask in order to produce specific pigments and/or chemical substances, such as vitamins, antibodies, or antimicrobial drugs. Devoid of cultural expressions and initially nearly colourless, these masks are paradoxically the most alive of the three series, said the MIT team. They literally re-engineer life by guiding living microorganisms through minuscule spatial features within the artifacts of the dead. In a contemporary world where making death masks is much less common practice, it is interesting to see how Oxman and her team have redesigned these objects, creating a set of tools and technologies to build programmable matter and, at the same time, given the concept of the death mask a new life. A trip to Melbourne, March 2018. We'd stopped for an eclair at an Italian pasticceria on the way to the National Gallery of Victoria and arrived in the late morning to see the inaugural NGV Triennial. I had already seen many of the works on Instagram and Mass 2016-17 by Ron Mueck, an installation of 100 oversized human skulls piled high in the gallery, was one of the things I was most eager to see in real life. I remember the excitement of glimpsing the skulls through the doorway from the gallery adjacent, and then the unreality of them as I stood close, so white, so big, so perfect. I wanted to reach out and touch them, but didn't. A child was playing near one of the skulls, and I worried that she would touch them. She didn't. I tried to photograph them, but someone was in the way, ruining my composition. Each visitor politely jostled for the best spot. Looking back, I realised that the sense of disconnectedness, that Mueck's skulls didn't feel real, was almost like experiencing the sublime. In my honours thesis, I'd written about the sublime as theorised by philosophers Edmund Burke, Immanuel Kant, and Jean-François Lyotard, but had rarely experienced it firsthand. I didn't feel terror or delight, two emotions described by Burke as part of the sublime experience. Instead, I had the sense that these jawless monstrosities were so large, so numerous, and so pristine that they were beyond my comprehension. It felt unreal, like they couldn't really exist in this space as the fully three-dimensional objects I knew them to be. Maybe there is just something about a skull, Mueck said of the work. The sight of a skull grabs us at an unconscious level. Even as children, we know what it is, what it means. It attracts and repels simultaneously. In archaeology, forensics, or investigative journalism, the image of a group of skulls begins to suggest a story, often an unsettling one. The skull has featured throughout art history, most often as a sign of death or danger. Skulls and skeletons were commonly used in Japanese art, as well as being made as nitsuke, decorative clothes toggles, or okimono, ornaments, from the 17th century. The skull and bones were often included in images of Christ on the cross from the Middle Ages through to the Renaissance, supposedly because Adam's bones were laid to rest below the cross. Later, the skull became a common memento mori, meaning remember, you will die, featuring in portraits and still life paintings alongside hourglasses, clocks, and guttering candles that signify that our time is numbered. In Albrecht Dürer's exquisitely detailed engraving in the NGV collection, St. Jerome in his study, 1514, the skull and the hourglass symbolise the scholar's mortality and are depicted among various objects, including cushions, slippers, and books, while a lion and a dog slumber peacefully at his feet. While death is a common subject for artists, designers are not traditionally associated with such existentially profound subjects. Design's history has generally been much more pragmatic. In the post-Second World War era, design was associated with the machine age, a sign of modernism and progress, as well as a signifier of a certain social status. Towards the end of the 20th century, as prices went up for designer goods, it became more often associated with luxury. Design was for the elite, as well as the upwardly mobile middle classes. Throughout, design was seen as a commodity, something to be acquired. Of course, all this is a fiction. Design is, and always has been, about much more than that. Design serves many functions, and one of these is communication. And in the world of communication design, the skull has a very clear meaning: death. The image of the skull and crossbones is commonly used on poison bottles to warn us of danger. This dates back to the 1800s, when it became law to label household products that were poisonous. And of course, the skull's use as a symbol dates back much further. In her book Hello World, Alice Rawsthorne points out that the Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones flag used by pirates to instill fear, is a textbook example of modern communications design, a precursor of today's corporate logos. Even though no one knows exactly why it's called the Jolly Roger, the first recorded sighting of the pirate flag was in 1700 by John Cranby of the British Navy ship HMS Poole. After that, its use spread rapidly, with the skull and crossbones sometimes accompanied by an hourglass or daggers. The spiky blob of COVID-19 is another powerful communication tool brought to us by design. Its purpose is to communicate the dangerous and viral nature of this disease. The image was designed by Alyssa Eckert and Dan Higgins and is part of a subgenre of design called medical illustration that is used in teaching, research, and scientific communications. Medical illustrators need to not only be designers, often specializing in graphics and/or 3D visualization, but also to have a science education. Eckert was a painter and scientist, while Higgins had a background in graphic design before they became medical illustrators at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in Atlanta, Georgia, USA. The pair designed the spiky blob of COVID-19 together in January 2020 before the public had any knowledge of it. The image is based on how the virus actually looks, the shape of the proteins, for example, but other aesthetic decisions, such as the colours, were made by the designers. Eckert said, "We really focused on the big red S proteins, the ones that make the coronavirus so contagious by attaching it to human cells." The designers also had to communicate the public health emergency that was unfolding. It had to be serious, but bold. Something really eye-catching. Eckert is clear that the purpose of the illustration was not to create fear, but to help the public to visualize the disease and act accordingly. Eckert says, "It gave a face to the unknown. That's how I think of it, because it gave people something substantial that they could hold on to and comprehend." It is not unusual for the images associated with a disease as dangerous as COVID-19 to become infused with some of the fear of death associated with the illness. Just look at the plague beak, a piece of medical equipment for those doctors treating the plague from the late Middle Ages to the 17th century. Plague doctors wore full-length gowns with hoods, gloves, and boots, finished off with a face mask in the shape of a long bird's beak that was filled with a posy, herbs traditionally used to ward off bad miasmas in the air believed at the time to carry the disease. In the 2020s, the plague beak has been replaced with personal protective equipment, PPE, the full-length suit, hood, and mask worn by doctors and nurses treating COVID-19 patients. While it's not as macabre as the plague beak, there is some fear associated with the suits, especially because they cover the face. Interestingly, the fear of a face hidden by a mask contrasts with the fear associated with the death mask, whose job is to capture a likeness. While one conceals, the other reveals. Some doctors and nurses have pinned photographs of themselves to their chest, so they bring some humanity to the interaction. Sitting here in my home office, writing this during Sydney's longest and most severe lockdown in winter 2021, I'm reflecting on how so much has changed in the world in the past 1.5 years. Yes, there was disconnection, loneliness, illness, and death before the pandemic, but now the negative has multiplied. You only have to watch the news to see it, or on second thoughts, turn the news off. As well as creating works that explore the concept of death, designers can have a hand in redesigning the objects directly linked to death. There's the urn for keeping ashes, the coffin, the gravestone. Recent redesigns of these objects include N-Cycle, a gravestone and urn designed by Sydney design studio Gibson Carlo in collaboration with Veena Sajwala from the UNSW Centre for Sustainable Materials Research and Technology, SMART at UNSW. The gravestone and urn are remarkable, not for their appearance, but for their material design. They are made from recycled materials, including waste fabric. The designers speculate that the deceased person's clothes could be used to create the gravestone and urn, thereby recycling waste materials and saving the use of primary materials in the creation of these objects. Another such project using recycled materials is the cardboard coffin, designed by Australian company Life Art and made from a specifically engineered cardboard called EnviroBoard, which is made from 97% recycled materials and produces up to 60% fewer carbon emissions than regular coffins made from MDF or particle board. Architects and landscape architects can also impact our perception of death through the architectural and landscape designs of crematoriums and cemeteries. A plan for a new cemetery called Acacia Remembrance Sanctuary, proposed for a bushland site on the outskirts of Sydney by architects Trophy and landscape architects McGregor Coxall, was created in response to the firm's belief that attitudes to death are changing. The design celebrates the natural environment and responds to an increasingly secular society, with the resting place of loved ones in unmarked graves locatable through GPS. An elevated walkway draws visitors through the bushland towards a walled garden, while at the heart of the site, a semi-enclosed pavilion provides a place for burial ceremonies. As a way of processing his own grief, US glass artist Fred Wilson created a magnificent chandelier, To Die Upon a Kiss, 2011, around the time of his father's peaceful death. The work, which was exhibited at the NGV Triennial in 2020-21 and supported by Professor A.G.L. Shaw A.O. Bequest, is part of the artist's decades-long work with black Murano glass, as well as an exploration of the history and presence of Africans in Venice and the Shakespeare play Othello. This elaborate chandelier, created in the Venetian tradition, features black at the base, which slowly transitions through to clear glass at the top, symbolising the body's dissolution through death. Wilson said, "When looking at To Die Upon a Kiss as a completed artwork, I saw my father's life force in the blackness of the chandelier, draining down from the body as his spirit rose out." Mourning jewellery has existed since ancient Rome, when skulls and skeletons, along with butterflies and cupid-like figures with the torch of life extinguished, were worn as memento mori. By the mid-17th century, the memento mori and mourning jewellery had combined. Rings in black enamel with initials, dates, and a coat of arms were worn to symbolise the death of an individual. From the 18th century, jewellery containing human hair was common, as seen in the 1782 mourning pendant from England in the NGV collection. Hair would be given in friendship between girls and between sweethearts, and after a person's death, a goldsmith would then place the hair, ornately curled and tied where the hair was cut, in a brooch, a ring, or a pendant. In Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, Heathcliff steals into the drawing room where Cathy's body lies in her coffin, opens the locket around her neck and replaces her husband Edgar's hair with his own. Later, the servant Ellen takes Edgar's discarded hair from the ground, twists it with Heathcliff's hair and places it in the locket around Cathy's neck, symbolising the fact that Cathy loved Heathcliff as much or more than her own husband. Contemporary jeweller Susan Cohn has also created a pendant about death and remembrance. Last the Blast 2006 was created in response to an interview she watched on TV with a couple who lost a daughter in the Bali bombings. Cohn was deeply affected by hearing that the family of the deceased did not have a body to bury and in fact did not have anything left of her. In response, the necklace pendant Last the Blast carries a message and is designed to survive a bomb blast. She says, "It just bubbled up. What if I made something that could send a message back? What if it was a piece of jewellery that someone was wearing?" Made of steel, ceramic and titanium, the pendant is bombproof, like the dog tags that soldiers wear to war to identify them. With this work, Cohn has not just created an object to commemorate a death, although it may do so. Instead, the work is designed to outlast death, acting as a messenger for loved ones left behind. Little 10-year-old me, who saw the death mask, did not think about death often, and many of us don't, for the majority of our lives. More recently, major world events such as the pandemic have brought the subject much closer. Importantly, designers, like artists, have a role in asking the big questions, including those of life and death, and in making us consider our own and others' deaths in new ways. Designers can also play an important role in communication design that warns of danger, in redesigning the objects surrounding mortality and in memorialising the departed. Because design isn't about progress and it isn't about luxury. It's about making life better, and that means making death better too.